Restless leg syndrome is no joke, but it sure is hard to describe to anyone else what it actually feels like and why it is so distressing. I have managed my restless legs for years with the help of extra iron and medication, but I sure remember some long, awful flights where the person next to me must have wondered what the heck was wrong with me, that I couldn't stop moving and jiggling my legs. Still, I spend most of my time standing or moving around. Sitting is something I rarely do for long. We're going to read two articles about restless legs, and then one longer article that focuses on other conditions that can cause leg pain while walking. This article gives good information on the causes of peripheral artery disease, chronic venous insufficiency, lumbar spinal stenosis, and diabetic neuropathy, as well as specific recommendations for treatment. I hope you enjoy our readings today. And we'll start with a reading from Health by Leah Groth and published on July 20th, 2020. This is titled Restless Legs Syndrome. You are snuggled under the covers of your bed, on the couch, watching television, or even driving home from work when you experience an uncontrollable and somewhat unpleasant urge to move your legs. Sure, it could be a muscle strain or random twitch, or it could be something else going on in your brain. Restless leg syndrome, commonly known as a sleep disorder, but better characterized as neurological sensory disorder, affects about 7 to 10% of the U.S. population, and women are more likely to have it than men, according to the National Institute of Neurological Disorders and Stroke, NINDS. While the condition is difficult to describe to those who haven't experienced it, and is sometimes difficult to diagnose, there are treatments available. Here's what you need to know about restless leg syndrome, including signs and symptoms, what can cause the condition, and what to do about it. Restless leg syndrome, RLS, also called Willis-Ekbom disease, causes unpleasant, uncomfortable sensations in the legs and an irresistible urge to move them, according to the NINDS. It's a sensory motor disorder, which is a disorder that affects both the sensory and motor systems in the body. Brian Koo, MD, Associate Professor of Neurology at Yale School of Medicine and Director, Yale Center for Restless Leg Syndrome Program, tells Health. Symptoms of the condition usually occur during the late afternoon or evening hours, typically increasing at night when the body's at rest. But it doesn't occur only during sleep. For the NINDS, symptoms can occur any time someone is inactive or sitting for an extended period of time. And while it usually occurs in the legs, in rare cases, people have reported similar sensations of restlessness in their arms, face, torso, and even genitals, says Dr. Koo. Overall, the symptoms of RLS consist of a distressing urge to move, often associated with sensory discomfort, says Dr. Koo. The NINDS adds that those specific sensations are often hard to describe, but many who suffer from the condition explain them as aching, throbbing, pulling, itching, crawling, or creeping. Those sensations can occur on one side of the body, both sides, or can alternate between sides. Because of these symptoms, frequently RLS symptoms impair sleep, says Dr. Koo. And while the initial symptoms are usually during the evening, those who suffer from RLS usually experience discomfort the following day as a result. The NINDS explains that RLS is one of several disorders that can cause exhaustion and daytime sleepiness and can have a negative impact on mood, concentration, job and school performance, and personal relationships. In fact, untreated moderate to severe RLS can lead to about a 20% decrease in work productivity and can contribute to depression and anxiety, per the NINDS. RLS is also linked to periodic limb movement of sleep, PLMS. About 80% of those who have RLS also have PLMS, which is characterized by involuntary leg or arm twitching or jerking during sleep that can happen every 15 to 40 seconds, sometimes throughout the night, per the NINDS. It should be noted, however, that while many people who have RLS also have PLMS, Not everyone who has PLMS has RLS. In most cases, it is not entirely understood what causes RLS in those with no other underlying conditions. This is called primary RLS. However, Dr. Ku points out that there is evidence that low iron levels may be a contributing factor. The NINDS points out that specific gene variants have been associated with RLS and that it can be found in families where the onset of symptoms is before age 40. There is also reportedly considerable evidence that RLS is related to a dysfunction in the basal ganglia, one of the sections of the brain that control movement that use the brain chemical dopamine. Dopamine is needed to produce smooth, purposeful muscle activity and movement. Disruption of those pathways frequently results in involuntary movements, the NINDS explains. That said, RLS has also been found to be connected to the following underlying conditions or factors, according to both the NINDS and Dr. Ku. End-stage renal disease and hemodialysis, certain medications like anti-nausea drugs, antipsychotic drugs, antidepressants, and some antihistamines, alcohol, nicotine, and caffeine use, pregnancy, neuropathy or nerve damage, neurologic diseases like multiple sclerosis or Parkinson's disease. RLS is diagnosed clinically by assessing if a person has the stereotypical symptoms, explains Dr. Ku. RLS most commonly becomes clinically apparent when sleep onset and maintenance are disturbed, he says. While there is no specific test for RLS, a doctor evaluates each case based on five basic criteria, per the NINDS. A strong and often overwhelming need or urge to move the legs that is often associated with abnormal, unpleasant, or uncomfortable sensations. The urge to move the legs starts or gets worse during rest or inactivity. The urge to move the legs is at least temporarily and partially or totally relieved by movements. The urge to move the legs starts or is aggravated in the evening or night. The above four features are not due to any other medical or behavioral condition. There's currently no definitive cure for RLS, but treatment focuses on controlling the condition, relieving symptoms, and increasing periods of restful sleep. Dr. Ku explains that ensuring that iron levels are normal, ruling out other sleep disorders which can exacerbate RLS, and eliminating habits which can make RLS worse, including alcohol and caffeine, are all the first steps in treatment. As far as medications go, quite a few can be used to treat RLS. The first line of treatment consists of anti-seizure medications like gabapentin or pregabalin. Dopamine agents, mostly used to treat Parkinson's disease, can also be effective, as can opiates, which are primarily used in only cases with severe RLS-specific side effects, says Dr. Ku. Unfortunately, RLS is a lifelong condition, per the NINDS, but with current therapies, symptoms can be minimized and restful sleep can be achieved. While it's always wise to see a doctor if RLS is disrupting your daily and nightly life, if RLS symptoms are mild and they don't produce significant discomfort or sleep disruption, the NINDS says the condition may not need treatment. And here's our second article on restless legs. This is written by John Lemattina, published on September 3rd, 2019, and written for Forbes. One of the most egregious attacks against the pharmaceutical industry is that it invents diseases by medicalizing conditions in such a way that it convinces healthy people that they are sick. Such behavior results in companies being able to fatten their sales and profits by selling drugs to people who really don't need them. Critics refer to this as disease mongering. In making their arguments, they use high cholesterol and bone thinning as prime examples of how companies do this. Is bone thinning a disease? Of course not. But if you are a petite female of Asian or Northern European background, bone thinning is the first sign of osteoporosis and should be treated. Similarly, an overweight male with a strong family history of heart disease and who has high LDL cholesterol needs to diet and exercise, and perhaps take a statin to reduce his risk of a cardiac event. These are not cases of disease mongering. Rather, it's preventative medicine. Another example of disease mongering, often cited by industry critics, is restless legs syndrome, RLS, which some believe is a nuisance and not a real condition. In fact, RLS is a sensorimotor disorder characterized by an unstoppable desire to move one's legs and is usually accompanied by irritation in the lower extremities. The biology underpinning RLS is not well understood. However, RLS is associated with poor sleep, depression, cardiovascular disease, ADHD, and obesity, all contributing to a poorer quality of life. Here are some descriptions by RLS patients of their condition. Imagine dragging a stiff bristled hairbrush across the sole of your foot over and over for 6 to 8 hours. Now try to imagine that sensation inside your legs. It's like having white-faced wasps in your leg bones, stinging and stinging. People who don't have it will never, ever understand the pain. The seriousness of RLS has now been elevated thanks to a recent study carried out by researchers at Penn State. The authors looked at a cohort of 169,373 participants in the U.S. and found that individuals with RLS had a higher risk of suicide and self-harm than did those without RLS. This association was independent of age, sex, geographical differences, depression, sleep disorders, other chronic medical conditions, and medication use. The authors stressed that the underlying mechanisms between the association of RLS and suicide and self-harm are unclear. While one might speculate that depression might be the driver, the authors found that the increased risk of suicide and self-harm in RLS patients were independent of depression. Comorbid sleep problems, sleep disturbance, insomnia, obstructive sleep apnea may be playing a role in elevating suicide risk in RLS patients, but research focusing on this as a possible cause remains scarce. While the drivers of increased suicide risk and self-harm in RLS patients are not defined, what is clear is that RLS is not a condition concocted by the pharmaceutical industry, nor is it simply a nuisance. RLS is a syndrome that affects roughly 5% of the population in Western countries, and in its severe form can be crippling. Given the increasing incidence of suicide in the U.S., it is imperative that RLS patients be treated rigorously and their health issues not be dismissed. And we'll move now to a different leg focus. This comes from Harvard Health Letter of June 21st, 2019, and is titled, "When Walking Makes Your Legs Hurt." When walking is supposed to be good for you, why do you have to suffer with leg pains, and what causes the pain in your legs when walking? Fitness experts used to stress the benefits of heavy-duty aerobic exercise, the kind that makes you breathe hard and gets your heart going. But the message changed to moderation after a number of studies showed that physical activity that's far less taxing is associated with lower rates of heart disease, some cancers, and several other illnesses, if it's done regularly. Plain old walking usually tops the moderate intensity exercise list because it's easy, convenient, and free, and it requires minimal equipment, a comfortable pair of shoes. The trouble is that walking isn't so easy for everyone. Indeed, the leg pain is agony for many, and forget the brisk pace of 3 to 4 miles per hour advised for health and fitness. With age, and occasionally without it, a number of conditions can result in leg pain after walking and make walking difficult. Some are very familiar, such as arthritis that makes knees and hips creaky. Others, such as peripheral artery disease, aren't. This article looks at 4 non-arthritic conditions that cause leg pain and may affect walking, and some ways to treat and manage them. No need to limp and bear it. Leg pain causes and conditions. We're discussing these conditions that may cause leg pain separately, but people may have 2 or more of them at the same time, which complicates diagnosis and treatment. Number 1, peripheral artery disease. Peripheral artery disease is a form of atherosclerosis, the same condition that leads to most strokes and heart attacks. Fat and cholesterol-filled plaque narrows arteries, and blood clots can collect on the plaque, narrowing them further. In peripheral artery disease, the arteries affected by atherosclerosis tend to be the ones that supply the leg muscles. The risk factors are similar to those for heart disease and stroke, smoking, high cholesterol levels, high blood pressure, and especially diabetes. The classic symptom is cramping, tight pain that's felt in muscles downstream from the narrowed artery. It can occur in the buttocks, thigh, calf, or foot, but occurs most often in the calf. The pain tends to come on with walking, gets worse until the person stops walking, and goes away with rest. Similar to angina, the pain caused by peripheral artery disease comes from working muscle cells that are starved for oxygen because of obstructed blood flow. The medical jargon for this kind of pain is intermittent claudication, from the Latin claudicatio for limping. Many people with peripheral artery disease have other sorts of pain, though. Sometimes their legs are heavy or they tire easily, and it's common for people to cut back on their activity level without realizing it, which can mask the problem. Signs of peripheral artery disease include a diminished pulse below the narrowed artery, scratches and bruises in the lower leg that won't heal, and pale and cool skin. The diagnosis usually depends on the ankle brachial index, which compares the blood pressure at the ankle to the blood pressure at the arm. They're normally about the same, but if there's a blockage in the leg, blood pressure will be lower in the ankle because of low blood flow. Peripheral artery disease by itself can be serious and debilitating, but it may also serve as an important warning of even more serious trouble. Atherosclerosis in the legs often means there's atherosclerosis elsewhere, and people with peripheral artery disease are 6 to 7 times more likely to have a heart attack, stroke, or transient ischemic attack than people without it. A peripheral artery disease diagnosis should prompt a concerted effort to rein in cardiovascular disease risk factors. Walking hurts, so a just-do-it attitude about exercise isn't helpful. But researchers have found that tightly structured, supervised exercise programs can help people increase the amount they can walk before their leg pain kicks in. These programs usually involve walking till it hurts, which may be only for a few minutes, resting till the pain goes away, and then walking again. These walk-rest-walk sessions are most effective if people do them for about 30 minutes, at least several days a week. Low-dose aspirin, 75 to 81 milligrams, is often recommended to reduce the risk of heart attack and stroke. Clopidogrel or Plavix, another drug that makes blood clots less likely by making platelets less sticky, is an alternative for people with aspirin allergy. Cilostazol or Pletol can help people walk longer distances without pain. Serious cases of peripheral artery disease can cause leg pain even when the person isn't walking. This rest pain most often occurs in the feet. Even more serious are cases when the condition leads to tissue death and gangrene. If peripheral artery disease is serious or isn't improving with exercise and medication, doctors can reopen the blocked artery with angioplasty or use part of a blood vessel from elsewhere in the body to reroute circulation around the blockage. But the track record of these revascularization procedures is mixed, and some studies suggest that the results from a structured exercise program can be as good or even better. 2. Chronic venous insufficiency. Like peripheral artery disease, chronic venous insufficiency is a condition of poor circulation, but involves the veins and the blood's return trip back to the heart and lungs. Our arteries are springy and help push blood along, but our veins are relatively passive participants in circulation. Particularly in the legs, it's the muscles surrounding the veins that provide the pumping power that drains the vessels near the surface of the skin and then push the blood up through the deeper vessels that travel toward the heart. tiny valves inside the veins even out the pressure and keep the blood from flowing backward. In people with chronic venous insufficiency, the valves are damaged, so blood tends to pool in the legs and feet instead of traveling north to the heart. It's often a vicious cycle. If the valves aren't working, pressure from the blood collecting in the veins increases, so the veins stretch out. As a result, the valves don't close properly, so even more blood flows backward, adding pressure. Symptoms include swelling, inflammation of the skin, dermatitis, and the connective tissue underneath, cellulitis, and ulcerated open wounds on the bony bumps of the ankle. Legs may feel achy or heavy, and when people walk, they may feel a tight, bursting pain, most often in the groin or thigh. The leg pain will stop with rest, but may take longer to ease up than the pain from peripheral artery disease. The symptoms from a mild case of chronic venous insufficiency can be helped by lying on your back and using a pillow to elevate your legs so blood flows downhill to the heart. If you're sitting for long periods, pointing your toes up and down several times can flex the vein-pumping leg muscles. More serious cases need to be treated with compression stockings that squeeze harder at the ankle than at the knee. For the stockings to work, they must be much tighter than the anti-embolism stockings people routinely wear in the hospital. But because they are so tight, people often have a hard time getting them on. Washing a new pair can help. Some people coat their skin with talcum powder or wear thin, regular stockings underneath. Devices called wire donners hold the stockings open so people can push a foot and leg into it. There are no specific medicines to treat venous insufficiency. Surgical procedures have improved significantly over the years. Nowadays, varicose vein therapy has moved very far away from the old-fashioned saphenous vein stripping. That procedure involved making an incision in the groin and leg, inserting a stripping device into the vein, and pulling the vein out of the body. It usually required general anesthesia, an overnight hospital stay, and weeks of recovery. Today, physicians usually close the vein permanently rather than remove it. They use one of several minimally invasive techniques performed through catheters inserted into the veins under ultrasound guidance. These treatments are performed in outpatient settings under local anesthesia, and the patient can walk immediately after treatment. Number 3, lumbar spinal stenosis. Stenosis is a medical term for any kind of narrowing. Spinal stenosis can occur anywhere along the spine as a result of the vertebrae, the discs between them, or their supporting structures impinging on the tube-like spinal canal that holds the spinal cord and the roots of the nerves that branch off of it. Pain comes from the mechanical pressure and perhaps also from the pinching off of blood flow to nerves. The lumbar region of the spine consists of the 5 large vertebrae that form the small of the back. When spinal stenosis occurs in the lumbar region, lower back pain can be a symptom, but often it's the legs that are affected. The pain can resemble the pain caused by peripheral artery disease, cramping tightness that increases with walking, although it's often felt in the thigh rather than the calf. The legs may also feel weak and numb. In the past, the leg pain caused by lumbar stenosis was called pseudoclaudication because it was unrelated to blocked arteries, and doctors didn't understand that it could be caused by spinal problems. Now, the preferred medical term seems to be neurogenic, which means originating from the nervous system, claudication. The diagnosis starts with discussion of symptoms and medical history. One important clue is whether the pain eases when the back is curved forward or flexed. That posture tends to take pressure off the lumbar region, and it's the reason some people with lumbar spinal stenosis find it easier to walk when leaning on a grocery cart or a walker. An MRI or CT scan will often be ordered to confirm a diagnosis, but imaging studies shouldn't be used to make one. Many people with spinal stenosis shows up on an imaging study but doesn't cause any symptoms. Treatment usually begins with physical therapy and exercises aimed at strengthening back and abdominal muscles. Pain relievers may help. Growing numbers of older patients are getting corticosteroid injections into the spine, which worries some experts. evidence that the shots are effective is mixed. If the pain persists, surgery is an option. The most common procedure is a laminectomy, which involves cutting away part of a vertebra to create more space for the spinal cord and nerves. Bone spurs and portions of the discs and facet joints can be removed to relieve pressure. Study results for surgery are murky. The majority of patients seem to feel better for the first year or so, but the advantage over a non-surgical approach seems to wear off after several years. A second operation is sometimes needed. On the other hand, for some, surgery greatly reduces the pain and discomfort. Number 4, diabetic neuropathy. People with diabetes are prone to nerve damage or neuropathy. Exactly why is uncertain. High blood sugar levels may damage the tiny blood vessels that supply nerves, creating nerve strokes. Nerves starved for oxygen, ischemic, because of damaged vessels. Diabetes may also deplete the body's store of neurotrophic peptides, chemicals that normally repair and regenerate nervous tissue. Diabetic neuropathy affects the upper and lower legs in different ways. In the upper leg, the pain from ischemic nerves can come on suddenly and be felt in just one leg. In the lower legs and feet, where it is more common, the symptoms are typically numbness or tingling and are usually felt about equally in both legs. The numbness often dulls painful sensations, so sores on the feet go unnoticed and get worse. Diabetic neuropathy can make walking difficult, but leg pain may improve with exercise. People with diabetes can reduce their chances of developing neuropathy by keeping their blood sugar down. It's less certain that tight blood sugar control is helpful once nerves have been damaged. Still, it's an important goal for many other reasons. Pain relievers, tricyclic antidepressants, and anticonvulsants are used to control the burning and tingling sensations from neuropathy. And we did it! We got all 3 articles in. I thank you for tuning in to Sound Body. Stay well, and please come back next week for more healthy living ideas.